I'm Jed Bodwin. I'm here with Hugo Fan and Fletcher Powell for the KMUW Movie Club. And this time out, we're talking about trilogies. And Fletcher, this was your idea.
Yeah, this was my idea. I pretty much forced you guys to do this, to talk about trilogies this time around, because I just watched the set of documentaries called Paradise Lost. And this is a set of three documentaries. The first one made around 1995 that follows, at that time, three teenagers who were tried and convicted for the murder of three little boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. And in that original movie, Paradise Lost, we go through the investigation and the trial and the ultimate conviction of these three. And a lot of questions are raised in the movie about whether or not they actually did what they've been convicted of doing, murdering these three little boys. It involves questionable confessions. It involves a whole lot of groupthink and paranoia about Satanism, because these three were heavily involved. They weren't even heavily involved. They just really liked heavy metal music, ultimately. And they were different. They wore black clothes, and that was pretty much it.
The murders had been part of a satanic ritual.
Satanic worship.
A horrific ritualistic sacrifice.
We're just sitting on the couch watching TV the night we were arrested.
They had to find somebody to pin this on. This publicity was getting out of hand.
So this movie came out. The three were convicted, and then because of this movie, I think it's safe to say because of this movie, there was a lot of attention paid to this case, and a number of people started to look at whether or not the evidence really supported these convictions. So a second movie came out in the year 2000, which followed these now men, who they were no longer teenagers, they were in their 20s, while they were in prison, while a separate group of people was trying to exonerate them. And a lot of questions become apparent about who may have actually done the murders, and it is someone who we've met before in the previous documentary. And then the third one came out in 2010, shows these men as men, and finally let out of prison under very bizarre circumstances, at least very bizarre legal circumstances. And the crazy part is the person in the second movie who it seems may have actually done the murders no longer seems to be the one who actually has done the murders. It seems to be even a third person. There are so many twists and turns in these documentaries. I realize I just talked for a whole long time just straight about them, but there's so many twists and turns. There's such a gut punch. My personal feeling is that I'm really glad I watched all three after the men had been let out of prison, because I don't know that I could have handled either of the first two knowing that they were in prison for what was very clearly something they hadn't done.
Yeah. And those movies, like living through them, especially the first one, this is not something that leaves you ever. But certainly that wait to see what happened became, and the conversations about it became something that was like really, you know, as I said, something that just year after year you couldn't help but think about and wonder about.
It's kind of like the prototype of what we have today in terms of this kind of, you know, examination of our justice society with, you know, making a murder and serial and even the OJ stuff that kind of resurfaced this year. I think the only difference between what is out today and this is just the concentration on community in general and kind of like the group hive mind, particularly around you know, when the murders happen.
And it's very strong, because we really do see a lot of people making a lot of assumptions about a couple of guys who are just a little bit different in this relatively small town in Arkansas. And yeah, you see that hive mind, and you see just how much momentum there was really to close this case and to convict these guys of something that ultimately there's no doubt whatsoever in anyone's mind that they didn't do it.
And of course, this goes on to become the cause celeb of recent years. The West Memphis Three is what these young men become known as.
Yep.
And everybody wants to basically help them become free again.
I, of course, chose this set of documentaries, which is a funny thing. When I think of trilogies, I don't necessarily think of a set of documentaries, but it turns out, Jed, you did the same thing.
Yeah, I did. And I did it with Penelope Spheris's The Decline of Western Civilization. And, of course, this starts back about the beginning of the 1980s with her looking at the punk rock scene in Los Angeles. You see a very young Black Flag, for instance, living in a church. And this scene that's going on in Los Angeles at that time, we tend to think about punk rock now. It's become sort of commodified, and it's this thing where it's like it's cool to have, a punk attitude and all this other stuff. But this is a period of time where you had police routinely busting up shows or harassing members of some of these bands, and even audience members harassing members of these bands. And to have lived in it was not necessarily as romantic as we see it now. And of course, they're living in squalor.
And I know the reason it didn't get, a wide distribution was that, studios wouldn't touch it because it was about punk rock. And even the LAPD chief.
Daryl Gates,
yeah. Has even told Penelope Spheeris never to, show this movie in L.A. ever again.
Why don't you cut your hair like that?
Because I'm searching.
What are you searching for?
I really don't know. Now I'll know when I find it. I did this because I felt like to set myself aside and make myself different. Maybe it would just come to me.
What is it?
No, that's not it.
Okay, this next song is for the LAPD. We got arrested the other night at Blackie's for playing punk rock music. They called us nuisance in public or something like that. Anyway, they put us in jail, and this song's called Revenge, and it's for them. It's not my imagination. I gotta go to my back. Come on, let's go, let me come back. We're gonna get revenge.
So this was a deeply underground movie and remained so for many years. Where I came into this trilogy was as a teenager seeing Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, The Metal Gears.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought it was a joke. The title was some sort of joke about, here comes the second decline of Western civilization. It's heavy metal. Because that was sort of the spirit of the time. I had no idea as a, 15 or 16-year-old kid that there had been this punk rock movie because it was so deeply underground. So out comes this heavy metal movie, which, again, at the time, keep in mind, a few years before this, they're talking about, heavy metal artists as Satanists. They're talking about them as, being drug-addled and all this other stuff. And in some ways, Penelope Spheeris proves them right.
Yeah, exactly. What you guys couldn't see just a little bit ago as Jed was talking about all that was me sticking my face into the table and laughing as quietly as I possibly could so that I didn't overwhelm what he was talking about. But that's exactly right. She kind of does, prove them right.
I have the same experience with you. I first came across Decline of the Western Civilization in kind of high school, and I was watching VH1, and I was watching a show called 100 Most Metal Moments, and one of them was Decline of Western Civilization, and then the scene with Chris Holmes in the pool.
Yeah, Chris Holmes of Wasp, who is this is the other thing, is that there is this frankness in the film, I think, that you tended not to see, because you would see, the talk show culture of the time and MTV culture and so on and so forth. People would come on shows and they plug their latest record and stuff. But here these guys are talking about, you're talking about substance abuse. Chris Holmes in that scene in his mother's swimming pool, deeply alcoholic and deeply disturbed. I mean, unfortunately, a talented guy who had some real, we would say today, self-esteem issues. To say nothing of, Lemmy from Motorhead basically saying that he's what, like a 9 point on the Richter scale of alcoholism.
Yeah, I did really enjoy seeing Lemmy, as a matter of fact, because a lot of the heavy metal artists that we see are relatively high profile people, and a lot of them have the huge big hair, and they're really into almost the glam aspect of heavy metal. And we've got Paul Stanley from Kiss, who actually does his interview while covered in scantily clad women, and says this is how he lives. So it was good to see Lemmy there as sort of a little bit of an antidote to the rest of that. But he still fits in, with the whole ethos, and he's fine with what everybody else is doing. He's kind of a delight in that movie. For me, I did not come to it from with the Metal years. I did come to it from the very first one. Now, I didn't see it for many years after it was released, but my cousin had a strange way of getting a hold of things that nobody else should be able to get a hold of, and being into punk rock in high school, he and I both watched that movie, and it was quite an experience. Going back and watching it now, it's even more of an experience because you really get that visceral sense of anger that a lot of kids were experiencing at that time around 1980 in Los Angeles. It's amazing to see some of the artists who you know have gone on to much bigger things. X is in the show, Exene Cervenka and John Doe, and you can tell even then how much talent they really have. Black Flag sounds terrible. They sound like they don't know how to play their instruments, but you know what they become. And then there's some other guys that you know commit suicide later that year.
Yeah.
It's kind of devastating, but it's also fascinating to go back and watch. And it really felt like the first and the third were of a piece. The third one, which we haven't mentioned, talks about gutter punks in Los Angeles. So these are the homeless kids who are really into punk rock, but clearly have a lot of problems. Many of them have been kicked out of their homes or had been abused in one way or another by their families. Most of them are alcoholic. There's some really awful stuff that happens late in the movie. That's kind of hard to take, and we know a lot of these kids just aren't going to make it. And so for me, that first and third installment really were of a piece. And then the Metal years, since I didn't come to it first, just seems strangely separate from the others. There are similar themes, like you've said.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting thing, right? Because the third installment of that deals with these kids who don't seem to have anywhere, as you said. And at least in the punk years and the Metal years, we encounter the same thing in the Metal years. Some of these kids are runaways. You know, some of them have deep, deep family issues that become apparent. And they had some place to go. They had the music. And then toward the end of this, I mean, we really do. We kind of live at a time where there is not the same kind of outlet.
Yeah, I have read that Penelope Spheeris is dead set on making Decline 4. She just won't say anything about it. Which I think is reasonable, but they are very much worth seeing as artifacts of very particular subcultures and a look at unfocused anger in a lot of ways, because these are in a lot of cases very angry young people and they don't know where to put it. And there are a lot of people like that out there, and it's really in your face with these movies.
And I know with 3, it came after a long period of time where after she had directed Wayne's World, she was directing all these comedies, and they were really unsatisfying. So she went back to Decline to go back to her roots.
Right, Penelope Spheeris, the director of Wayne's World. In addition to these very hard and difficult documentaries, yeah, she's a talent.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is that she's making, you know, for instance, the first Decline film as an independent female filmmaker. Mm-hmm. She gets this financing herself, and she really struggled to get to that point where she was able to make films. Her story is endlessly fascinating for me. And then to see that turn that she makes, of course, directing these kind of mainstream comedies.
Well, Jed and I, of course, both chose documentaries and documentaries that span quite a bit of time. Hugo did something sort of similar in that he chose movies that span quite a bit of time, but these aren't documentaries, which also makes them not exactly unique in the film world, but very close.
Yeah, I chose Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, which is also known as the Before Trilogy. It's about two people, and they meet on a train one day in Austria, and they kind of just walk and talk throughout the city, and the movie kind of just follows them. Then after that, you know, they leave, and they leave on this ambiguous ending, and, you know, it's this whirlwind romance, and you're left wondering if they're going to see each other again.
I always feel this pressure of being a strong and independent icon of womanhood and not making look like my whole life is revolving around some guy. But loving someone and being loved means so much to me. I always make fun of it and stuff. But isn't everything we're doing in life a way to be loved a little more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I dream about being a good father and a good husband. And sometimes it feels really close. But then other times, it seems silly, like it would ruin my whole life. And it's not just a fear of commitment or that I'm incapable of caring or loving, because I can. It's just that if I'm totally honest with myself, I think I'd rather die knowing that I was really good at something, that I had excelled in some way, than that I'd just been in a nice, caring relationship.
Yeah. But I had worked for this older man, and once he told me that he had spent all of his life thinking about his career and his work, and he was 52, and it suddenly struck him that he had never really given anything of himself. His life was for no one and nothing. He was almost crying saying that. You know, I believe if there's any kind of God, it wouldn't be in any of us. Not you or me, but just this little space in between. If there's any kind of magic in this world, it must be in the attempt of understanding someone, sharing something. I know, it's almost impossible to succeed, but who cares, really? The answer must be in the attempt.
And then 9 years later, an unlikely sequel came up, and it was Before Sunset, and they do see each other again. And, you know, they do the same, pretty much the same thing, and it does the same thing at the end of that. And then fast forward to about 2012, and they end up getting together, and they have two children. And you know, that movie pretty much focuses on life being together and just being together at the age of 40. So it's this examination of just different stages of your life and the types of relationships that, you know, happen around at that age. The thing I love about Richard Linklater is just how he deals with time. You know, and a lot of his movies are about time. You know, either a time and place or just a large span of time. And this is kind of one of his first far away with that type of idea of just doing something over a large span of time.
Yeah, when Hugo says the first one happens and then 9 years later an unlikely sequel happened, that was literally 9 years, and it's 9 years in the characters' lives. I think the first one came out in 1995. Let's say the next one then came out in 2004. And then the third one, they waited another 9 years. Yeah, and so we'll say that was 2013. And you do see how those characters change over those periods of time. But what's amazing to me, and part of this is also due to Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, who are the two actors who play the characters in the movie. What's amazing to me is that they are still the same people they were in the first movie. They have just changed in the way that people change.
I don't believe in anything that relates to love. I don't feel things for people anymore. In a way, I put all my romanticism into that one night, and I was never able to feel all this again. Like, somehow this night took things away from me, and I expressed them to you, and you took them with you. It made me feel cold, like if love wasn't for me.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
The things that they do are things that their characters would do, and you can trace lines back to the first movie and see that is in their character to do those things. And it feels, by the third one, it feels really earned. And that's something that you don't get a lot out of movies. It's something you can only do with time. And it's something that Richard Linklater is brilliant at, is making you feel like he's really earned these moments, these emotional moments in these movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say that this was a turning point for me. The first film was a turning point for me with Ethan Hawke, because he had been in some movies that I appreciated, but I didn't necessarily always appreciate him as an actor, especially in Reality Bites. I really not only disliked that film, but I disliked the character intensely. And so seeing him in this climate was such a switch, and I've had such a deep appreciation for him since then.
Did you think he was unlikable in Reality Bites?
You know, Ethan Hawke, when Richard Linklater was looking for people to cast in the movie, he was basically looking not just for actors, but for collaborators. And, you know, he found that in Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. And you know, for years, Julie Delpy has said that she helped write the first movie, even though she wasn't credited. And then subsequently, with those two ones after, Ethan Hawke and Richard Linklater and Julie Delpy both wrote scripts for those mm-hmm. as well.
And something as a result of that that was baffling to me, and I finally understood what had happened. The Academy Awards nominated Before Midnight for an adapted screenplay, and it took me forever to figure out why. And the reason was it was based on pre-existing characters. Those pre-existing characters being the characters that they played in the first two movies. So, you know, the ins and outs of the Academy. I want to say one more thing, at least, about Richard Linklater earning his moments. And that's that Before Midnight is really tough, in my opinion, to watch. Mm-hmm. Because the two characters played by Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke have a difficult relationship by this point. There's a lot of resentment for a lot of things. And the last portion of the movie is honestly a big, long fight. And it's tough, and it's cutting, and it does not feel good. Now, most movies I watch like this, I'm thinking most specifically of This Is 40, because I think it came out around the same time, that feature two characters, two married people just fighting. I can't stand it, because I just get plopped down in the middle of a movie, these people are fighting, and I'm somehow supposed to relate to it. I don't know these characters, right? But with these movies, they've earned it. And you see the way they behave, and when they behave in nasty ways, you can still trace those lines back to how their characters have behaved in the earlier movies. We do know these characters, and I think it's really important, and it really is an earned moment, and it makes that the devastation of that fight even more real and difficult to watch, but real and earned.
And if you go back to the first movie, they talk about their first fight, and you kind of just you can juxtapose it with their last fight, and just how, you know, how much they've grown and how big, you know, it's gotten, and mm-hmm. just it's really a giant contrast.
You know, you raise an interesting point with this idea of the characters earning that place. And I'm struck by we're looking at films that come in a sequence, which I suppose would technically make them sequels, but these don't have the attributes of sequels. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in the Linklater films, these are just more episodes in a single life, and I don't think you can pull off that same kind of emotional pow in a film where it's set up as a sequel. In the way that these are set up differently as part of something greater. You know what I mean?
I think so. I think that's a really good point. Just one more little thing. Richard Linklater's direction in these movies is also just fantastic. Just the movements the characters make at particular times. I'm thinking specifically of one moment relatively early on in the first film, in Before Sunrise, when the two are in a listening booth in a record store, and it's you hear the music, but everything else is mostly silent, and the two of them share this moment where they're each sort of stealing glances at the other one, and each looks away as the other one looks toward him or her, and it sort of plays back and forth, and that's just kind of a magical moment. And I suppose it's possible that was improvised, but I'm going to give all the credit of that to Richard Linklater. He's just amazing.
So, I mean, this is something that's interesting. We've talked in this club quite a bit about his movies, and it strikes me that he is a much, much more diverse director than I think, until recently, people have really given him credit for.
Yeah, definitely. He's somebody maybe along the lines of Steven Soderbergh, who is able to make a lot of different kinds of movies. Soderbergh likes to play in genre more than Richard Linklater does, I think. But you're right. I mean, obviously, School of Rock is quite different from Boyhood, for example, or certainly from Slacker, Linklater's breakout movie. But yeah, he's able to play in a lot of different sandboxes.
For a while, I know he was struggling for a long time, particularly after Before Sunset. You know, he meets a string of movies that a lot of people didn't like. Suburbia,
The Newton Boys.
The Newton Boys.
I actually didn't mind The Newton Boys.
And then he made a couple of experimental movies, Waking Life, Scanner Darkly. And then there came the big comedies, obviously, The School of Rock and Bad News Bears. But then he returned to form with, Bernie and Before Midnight and Boyhood. And
I had forgotten that he did Bernie, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, having talked about our three picks for this time around, let's blow things open a bit and talk about trilogies in a much larger sense. It's interesting to me that all three of us chose trilogies that clearly were not intended originally to be trilogies. Mine never would have taken off. The Paradise Lost movies never would have taken off if people hadn't started to pay attention to what was really going on with the conviction of the teenagers. Jed's, I think The Decline of Western Civilization, the first one, as Jed said, almost didn't get made at all. Certainly the next two were no guarantee, and I doubt she had any idea in mind of making more than one. And then the Before trilogy, again, was made just as Before Sunrise, and they decided to revisit the characters later on. Not only that, but all three of ours could potentially turn into four-parters. There's no reason that they couldn't. So I guess I wonder just a little bit about what you guys think about intended trilogies versus non-intended trilogies. I mean, there are movies that are set out to be trilogies. Certainly, of course, something that's adapted from books like The Lord of the Rings would be. But there's a big difference, I think, between those kinds of movies, and I just wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Well, I think I think there's like a kind of like a basis within a body of work, an oeuvre, you know. So I always think about Wes Craven, and you know, we tend to think about trilogies being this kind of high-minded thing, and we tend to think of horror films not being particularly high-minded. But when I look at something like Last House on the Left with The Hills Have Eyes, and even the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie, these are films that ask questions about morality. You know, it's like when you're under attack, and Craven said this himself, you know, who are the real savages? You know, so it's like when your family's under attack, how do you react to that? And to what lengths do you go to? And then, you know, when you have a pedophile living in the neighborhood, is it the right thing to burn him alive?
You know, not tell your children.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but these are, I mean, those are the basic moral questions that are in them. Certainly, I don't think he would have said, I'm someday going to make this kind of film. But thematically, they connect and they inform, I think, even works that are outside of those realms in his overall body of work.
Two things. One, we all just laughed at pedophile being burned alive. The other thing is that you bring up a really good point, which is sort of the idea of spiritual trilogies. And those Wes Craven movies you mentioned, all thematically similar. This is a whole other part of film history, is these sets of movies that share some sort of point of view or some comment on the world.
The Whit Stillman trilogy is a great example of that. And, you know, the themes of all of those are pretty much just kind of, you know, kind of a skewering of just rich urbanites. Started off with a film called Metropolitan, and it was kind of about his life, you know, and how he lived in New York, and just him, you know, dealing with these social circles of just these rich kids, and you know, every subsequent movie after that had that kind of theme. Barcelona, as well as Last Days of Disco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's only actually made five movies within the past like 30 years. But these Metropolitan, Barcelona, and The Last Days of Disco are considered the Whit Stillman trilogy, and it's just they all thematically have the same themes, and they all kind of have the same actors as well. But they're very funny, and I really like them a lot.
So. Yeah, I mean, and for instance, you know, Paul Schrader, like he has taken up the idea of the American male in a number of his films. Certainly what Taxi Driver is about, a certain type of American male, the sort of vigilante, we might say, and that sort of lone wolf mentality. But then you have something like Affliction, which is his adaptation of Russell Banks's novel, where you have this kind of disappearing version of an American male, quite literally in the case of Nick Nolte's character at the end of the film, but also his father, played by James Coburn, where there's this generational drift. Both men are extremely angry, and Nick Nolte kind of represents this kind of man that cannot continue to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have Autofocus, which is another kind of American male, this kind of narcissistic, sex-obsessed man who will basically stop at nothing to make sure that his needs are met, and it ultimately costs somebody their lives.
When you look at those movies, you see all of those themes, and yet they certainly, any one of them you could watch individually, they do not all look the same. They're not retreads of the same story over and over. They build on those themes.
And there are themes that we kind of superimpose on directors themselves, and we start to notice these trends. I think I noticed that one of them is probably Quentin Tarantino.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He kind of works in threes a little bit. His first three, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Jackie Brown, are kind of heist movies. His next three, Kill Bill 2, and Death Proof, are kind of like these femme fatale movies. And then you have Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained and Hateful Eight, which are kind of period piece movies, period piece revenge fantasy movies.
And which he's explicitly referred to as a trilogy.
Yes.
So we've got these sort of spiritual trilogies. We've got these trilogies that clearly were not intended to be trilogies. We've got adaptations that clearly need to be trilogies. What about movies that more or less seem to be trying to make a big money grab? I'm thinking about The Matrix trilogy, which shouldn't have happened. And I'm thinking about The Hobbit, which didn't need to be a trilogy. So The Matrix, obviously highly successful. Everybody loved The Matrix when it came out. For no reason I can think of, they decided to make two bloated sequels, one of which I've never seen, so maybe I shouldn't say that it's awful. I have not seen the third one. The second one I didn't feel was worth my time. And I really enjoyed The Matrix. It was a lot of fun. But these next two movies come out, and it almost seems like they felt compelled to do that because that's the thing you do, is to make a trilogy.
Well, yeah, I would point to, and when we started talking about this kind of brainstorming, I immediately went to the Back to the Future films.
Uh-huh.
Because there is a wonderful original film, in my opinion, funny, mm-hmm. everything you could want, and then they have to yutz it up with a sequel, a second film that makes absolutely no sense. I remember seeing an interview with Michael J. Fox at the time it came out, and he's like, bring a roadmap, because it goes nowhere. And then a third one that is just makes you really dislike these characters who you've come to love in the first film because you're so sick of them. And I think that it's obviously we live in a time where marketing is very much at the fore over content in a lot of these films.
And if you were talking about two, you know, that's marketing, and two is just the product placement is insane.
You're speaking of Back to the Future too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, Back to the Future.
Well, it's almost a parody of itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it becomes like this, you know, just blatant cash grab that I just, as a film goer, I don't want to participate in. I get to the point where I get sort of turned off by that idea of hearing trilogy.
Well, so what's our obsession with trilogies? I mean, you've got...
Well, I think that it's only natural that, you know, people gravitate, you know, towards three parts in certain things.
But it's bad enough now that we have, say, four movies wherein they split what would have been the third movie into two movies and call it, you know, whatever, action movie 3 part 1, action movie 3 part 2. It's
well, that's more of a young adult thing.
But it's that obsession with trilogies that it doesn't make a lot of sense to me why it necessarily needs to be that way. And I'm not sure when it really blew up. You mentioned the Back to the Future movies. So I guess, was it Star Wars or was it Lord of the Rings that really made it explode? Star Wars, I think, certainly had something to do with it happening. But when it really exploded, I guess I wonder which of those two or something else entirely it was.
Oh, I would definitely say it came down to Lord of the Rings, because I think, remember the Star Wars movies. First of all, the first one gets made and there's no guarantee that that's going to be a, you know, that lives as a trilogy basically in the mind of George Lucas for a period of time. And even when you look at the three of them, they're all different enough that you still go, oh, okay, right. I can put them together if I want to. I can, you know. And so I really think it's Lord of the Rings, which is kind of funny because that story predates Star Wars and maybe predates Back to the Future, depending on whether you believe in time travel.
Clever. Well, it probably influenced Star Wars too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
I disagree. I think it did start with Star Wars, and it specifically started with George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. You mm-hmm. know, if you look at, you know, the movies that they did throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you have Star Wars, you have Indiana Jones, works in three, Jurassic Park works in three. you know, all these, you know, these movies that they started the blockbuster, and they started, you know, Star Wars was inspired by serialized filmmaking. That's mm-hmm, why there true. Was three of them.
As was Indiana Jones.
As was Indiana yeah. Jones, yeah. So that's, I think it started at Star Wars.
Okay. I certainly agree with Star Wars and Indiana Jones. I would take issue with Jurassic Park because I think both Lost World and every Jurassic Park since then have been cash grabs, which isn't to say whether they're good or bad. I just think they wouldn't exist had Jurassic Park not been such a massive hit to begin with.
I think there's also this need that people have to want to know the rest of the story, which is where I have to like really give a lot of kudos to Steven Spielberg for instance, never making a sequel to E.T.
He's made spiritual sequels to E.T.
But again, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so here's the thing. What about the reluctant like third installment? I mean, we see these occur sometimes, right? Where it's like, there's the first two movies, and then it's kind of like, well, we got to make another one because that will complete things.
So you're talking about The Godfather Part 3.
Yes.
yeah, and sometimes you can see that they are not as successful as the first two. I don't think The Godfather Part 3 is as awful as people like to pretend it is. It's not as good as the first two, but what is? Mm-hmm. And then I would say a similar thing about the Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead trilogy. Day of the Dead is almost to me like The Godfather Part 3 of that trilogy. Again, it's not as bad as people like to pretend it is, but it is problematic. It does seem like those are older examples, but what you're saying seems to ring true in that it does sometimes feel like, okay, we need that third movie for the trilogy because people can't handle just two movies telling a story. Again, we can go back to The Hobbit. They split it into three movies when it could have been one movie. It would have been great at two movies. It's absurd at three movies. I can't watch the entire thing. Many of my friends' children can't watch the entire thing, and they love the book. They love the book with all their heart, and it just didn't need to happen.
The thing that people clamor for is kind of closure. And the third one, there is a trend that it's not as good. I think the best example of it is one of the best examples, at least, is The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is closure, but obviously it's not as revered as the first two. Not same thing with Godfather, and you know, I would say the same thing about Star Wars. You know.
Well, we've wandered around definitely quite a bit talking about trilogies, but I think there are a lot of different issues that come up, and obviously a limited amount of time here. But since we've wandered so much, I'm going to indulge myself just a little bit and recommend two trilogies. One is a trilogy of an actor and director. I want to talk just briefly about Viggo Mortensen and David Cronenberg with A History of Violence, Eastern Promises, and A Dangerous Method. Now, three movies by the exact same director, David Cronenberg, starring the same actor, Viggo Mortensen. And Mortensen is completely different in each of these movies. And each of these movies has a completely different feel. It's fascinating to watch. It really helps you understand both what an amazing actor Mortensen is and what a great director David Cronenberg is. And I've always thought of those three movies together because it's just amazing to see how different the same people can be in this art form. The other thing I want to recommend is something that's something that sometimes happens with trilogies. It works kind of outside the box. It's a trilogy called the Red Riding Trilogy, and it was on British television, very loosely based on the Yorkshire Ripper, but it's three movies taking place in three different time periods, all directed by different directors, but dealing more or less with the same overall arc. And I want to say that this is a very, very difficult set of movies to watch, but I highly recommend it if you have the stomach for it. And watching the different directors and how they take some of the same characters and mesh them together while still telling entirely individual stories in each movie is just kind of mind-blowing. There are also tiny little nods to each of the other movies in each of the three movies, something in the background that just might make you say, what is going on back there? And then two movies later, oh, you learn, and it's crushing. So anyway, I just wanted to get those out there, that Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen trilogy, and definitely the Red Riding movies.
Not a trilogy, but actually a decalogue. And this is the Polish television series, The Decalogue, based on the Ten Commandments. It came out in the 1980s and is each of those. It was shown on Polish television at the time. And each one of those gives you a very, shall we say, interesting take on the commandment which it corresponds to, and is highly recommended. Highly recommended.
Krzysztof Kieslowski, and recently, either recently re-released or about to be re-released and remastered. We could do this movie club for a decade and probably not recommend something better than the Decalogue. Go watch the Decalogue. If you don't watch anything else ever again in your life, go watch the Decalogue. Okay, we've gone completely off the rails recommending a 10-part movie while we were supposed to be talking about trilogies, so it's probably time to wrap this up. Let us know about your favorite trilogies, your thoughts on trilogies, why we're wrong about trilogies. Tweet us at KMUW. You can email us at info@KMUW.org. Hit our Facebook page with whatever you've got in mind. This is fun, guys. Three of us, three movies, nine movies, whatever, 10 movies. I don't even know what I'm saying. All right. For Jed Bodwin, for Hugo Fan, I'm Fletcher Powell. This has been the Movie Club, KMUW. Bye.